Please turn with me tonight to 1 Samuel chapter 22. When we were last together, we saw how David has begun to be on the run from King Saul, and he has tried a couple of things. First, he went to a village called Nob, where there were priests of the Lord presiding over the sanctuary, and there Ahimelech gave him bread. He gave him what the old translations called the showbread, the holy bread that was replaced weekly, and the former loaves were to be eaten only by the priests. And yet, in an extraordinary act of mercy, Ahimelech gave David the bread that usually the priests ate to satisfy his hunger. And it is Jesus who reminds us of that principle of mercy and not sacrifice when the disciples were getting their food from the grain fields on the Sabbath day. And in so doing, Ahimelech, as we're going to see in this chapter tonight, sealed his doom because someone was there who watched the interaction between David and Ahimelech. His name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of Saul's herdsmen. David fled from there, of course, to Gath, the city of the Philistines, and went to Achish, the king of the Philistines, hoping that Achish wouldn't recognize him. But almost as soon as he got into town, the servants of Achish said to him, "Is not this David the king of the land?" And so David began to feign insanity to avoid being killed. Achish concluded that he had enough madmen among his Philistines and said he didn't need another one. So he banished David instead of killing him. And as the chapter opens tonight in verse 1, it says, "David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam." This is probably a site near Jerusalem, down to the southwest. And if the next part of the verse says, "And when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him." Do you think that there might have been any other motive to that other than sheer family loyalty?
I think they were afraid of Saul too.
They were afraid of Saul too, yes. In other words, they now understood the true nature of Saul. They understood that their own lives were in danger, and they went to join their son in this hiding place. But verse 2 says a lot of other people did too. There were, by this time, a lot of other discontented and disaffected people in the kingdom. It says, "And everyone who was in distress, and everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was bitter in soul, gathered to him, and he became captain over them, and there were with him about 400 men." So the outcasts and the misfits and those who have no doubt run afoul of King Saul, or who for other reasons are sympathetic to David, are joining him and his family. And David, who didn't have any men with him at the time he went to Ahimelech and said he did, now does have an army of about 400 men. And the term captain is a military term here. It's rightly translated captain. But David is, of course, not trying to foment any kind of rebellion or insurrection. He is just simply trying to escape from Saul and provide for his loved ones. And so it says in verse 3 that David went from there to Mizpah of Moab. That's the neighboring country over to the east. And he said to the king of Moab, "Please let my father and my mother stay with you till I know what God will do for me. And he left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. Now, why would David go to Moab? Any ideas? Any advantage to going to Moab that you can think of? Moab was not always allied with Judea. They had differences and they were frequently at enmity. Why would David go there? Well, blood ties play a part. David was the descendant of a Moabitess whose name was Ruth. And so it would have been a natural choice to go to Moab with his family. Jesse, of course, was also descended from Ruth, and he takes his mother and father there to the king of Moab, asks him very respectfully if they can stay with him. Now, there are two things that we learn about David in this verse, and they're extremely important because, of course, as we go through the story of David, we're learning disappointing things about him. We're learning about how he often does foolish things when he is driven to desperation, how he is not above concocting a lie, or at least a lie, of course, for the sake of King Saul, and a prevarication or a misleading bit of casuistry for Ahimelech the priest. But we also learn a lot of good things about David. David is very much like Horatio said at the end of Hamlet when he's looking at Hamlet's dead body and he talks about how the elements were mixed in him. Well, David is that way. He has qualities that we're not going to always admire, and that is the characteristic of all Bible heroes. They are painted warts and all, as Oliver Cromwell requested to be painted. We see their weaknesses. We see their sinfulnesses. They are sinners saved by grace, just like we are. When you look at the roll call of saints in Hebrews 11, you can find almost as many things wrong with them as you can right about them. And David is no exception. But in verse 3, he demonstrates a couple of excellent qualities here. And the first one is his care for his mother and father. This is, of course, simply nothing less than the keeping of God's commandment to honor your father and mother. And it is a great blessing to those who do so because, as it says in the Mosaic Law, your days will be long with you in the land which the Lord your God gives to you. And, of course, the commandment is repeated in the New Testament in Ephesians chapter 6. It says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother. This is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you and that you may live long in the land. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is Paul simply quoting that and saying, is that true for you in the same way that it was for the people going into the land of Canaan? Or does he mean that things are going to go well simply in life on earth with those who honor their father and mother? In any event, it is definitely a command for the Christian. It is part of the law of Christ. And David honors his father and mother and is very careful to take care of them, even if it means sending them into another country. The other thing we learn about David in this verse that I think is really commendable is the phrase, till I know what God will do for me. What does that tell you about David? Yes, he has faith that God is going to help him. He recognizes himself to be in the hands of God, and that's where he wants to be. You see, if I had been David at this point and, you know, taken my parents, say, to the neighboring country, Louisiana, or something, said to the governor of Louisiana, take care of them, I would have probably ended the sentence by saying, till I figure out what I'm going to do. Till I figure out what I'm going to do. But David didn't look at it that way. He knew that God was in control, that God was sovereign, that God had a plan for him. God was the one who had sent Samuel to find somebody in Jesse's house to anoint with oil, and good for Samuel. He knew that all the brothers weren't the right one, and he asked for the one remaining, and that was David. And David was anointed, and Jonathan, his friend who is the rightful successor to the throne, has already told him he expects him to be king, and he wants him to deal favorably with his descendants. So David knows that the hand of God is upon him. And that is a tremendous thing to know when you're going through all kinds of trouble, when you're being pursued and persecuted and everything's against you, and you go from living in Gibeah with the daughter of the king as your wife to hiding out first in a cave in Adullam, and then finally going plumb over to Moab and being there in enemy territory. David trusted that God would do whatever for him. And that's where we should be as Christians, and especially when we seem to be going through adversity or tragedy, we have to remember verses like, God works all things together for the good of those who love Him, who are the called according to His purpose. And we have to remember, God will perfect that concerning you. And we have to remember, He who began the good work within you will perform it until the day of Christ Jesus. God has His plan for people. And even though it looks like the plan could be thwarted or could even be shattered, the plan is there, and that is the essence of faith. You remember when we studied the 11th chapter of Hebrews, we talked about the faith of all of those Old Testament saints. And faith, of course, is the assurance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. And so you have the assurance of something that you hope for that you don't presently have. And you have the evidence of things not yet seen in the essence of faith. And every one of those Old Testament saints who had faith had received the word of the Lord, and they were simply believing it no matter what. Whether it was Abraham who went out to a strange country, whether it was Moses who endured as seeing Him who is invisible, regardless of who it was, Noah building an ark to the saving of his household, everybody in that great list of Old Testament saints simply believed God in spite of circumstances. And that's what David is doing. He says, I don't know what's going to happen to me yet, but take care of my mother and father until I know what God will do for me. So it's a tremendous example of faith. And David has it. He is, after all, the one who wrote our great devotional aid to faith, the book of Psalms, in so many instances. So he left them with the king of Moab. They stayed with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. There's going to be another stronghold mentioned later on in the book. This is not that later stronghold, because this is a stronghold in Moab. This is a stronghold that he and his men went to there. And we read in verse 5, then the prophet Gad said to David, do not remain in the stronghold, depart and go into the land of Judah. So David departed and went into the forest of Kereth. Let me have you notice in verse 5 that a new character has just been introduced. He's a prophet named Gad. This is the first time we read about him. And he tells David to do something, and he does it. Why is that unusual in this book? We're always having men of God tell people to do things in this book that they don't do. A man of God told Eli to rebuke his sons. Samuel was told to tell Eli what would happen to his sons. And then, of course, there's Samuel and Saul, telling Saul to wait till he arrives before he launches an attack. But David gives full weight to the authority of this new prophet that we're just getting introduced to, named Gad. And he says to him, "Do not remain in the stronghold. Depart and go into the land of Judah." And David knows that that's where he's in trouble, back in the land of Judah. But he so trusts the word of the Lord to come through Gad that he departs and goes back to Judah to this forest. And this distinguishes him very much from Saul. Now the scene shifts in verse 6. And Saul heard that David was discovered and the men who were with him. Saul was sitting at Gibeah, that's at headquarters, but now it's outside, under the tamarisk tree, which must have been a very unique tree, and scholars say it is, and it must have been a landmark, under the tamarisk tree on the height, with his spear in his hand, and all his servants were standing about him. What's the significance of "with his spear in his hand"? Yeah, that's right. Smokey's right. This is the weapon with which he has both tried to kill David and his own son, Jonathan. And so when you read "with his spear in his hand," you have to know that he is up to no good at this point. And there he is with various members of his retinue, members of his administration. All of his servants are standing about him. And in verse 7, Saul said to his servants who stood about him, "Hear now, people of Benjamin." Why are they people of Benjamin? Why don't we have a few Reubenites and people from Issachar? Saul was a Benjamite. So what's he done? He has surrounded himself with his countrymen. He has surrounded himself with people who will willingly follow him and agree with him and support him. So he says to his servants, "Hear now, people of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds, that all of you who have conspired against me, all of you have conspired against me? No one discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. None of you is sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servants against me to lie in wait as at this day." Let's start, first of all, with the thing that stands out the most. What is Saul saying here? How is he behaving? What's his primary concern?
"What benefit for you? You're going to follow me, and I'll give you all this."
Yes, that's an interesting thing, because if you turn back to 1 Samuel 8, look back at 1 Samuel 8 when the whole issue of Israel demanding a king came up. And Samuel went to the people to tell them, "You're making a mistake." If you look at 1 Samuel 8, verse 10, So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking for a king from him. He said, "These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his implements of war and the equipment of his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his servants. He will take the tenth of your grain and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and to his servants. He will take your male servants and female servants and the best of your young men and your donkeys and put them to work. He will take the tenth of your flocks and you shall be his slaves. And in that day you will cry out because of your king whom you've chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day." Look at what's happened. All this stuff has come to pass. The king has done exactly what Samuel predicted he would do. And he has made his own cohorts commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds, and he seems to have given them fields and vineyards that he has confiscated from other people, just exactly like Samuel said he would. And so he is making sure that he continues to have their loyalty here. He says, "Are you going to get all of these perks that you get in serving me from this renegade son of Jesse? Are you going to go over to his side? I'm the one to whom you now owe things." And then he accuses them of conspiracy against him. What characteristic of Saul are we seeing emerging again here? Paranoia. And he is the victim, isn't he? He loves to play the victim. He says, "You've all conspired against me." And then he says in verse 8b, "No one discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. None of you is sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day." What's wrong with that sentence? Nobody stirred David up to lie in wait against Saul. David's not out lying in ambush waiting to kill Saul. This is all in Saul's mind. This is all in Saul's mind. He is deluded. He is paranoid. And he is absolutely, he's absolutely got a victim mentality. One time, a lady came to me because she was very, very worried about a situation at her job. She saw this little sign, that little indication, and another little indication. And she had come to this fantastic conclusion that they were out to get her. And I said, "Well, you know, I just don't think you know enough to be worried yet. Why don't you wait a few weeks and come back to me when you know enough to be worried? There are other alternative explanations for these things that do not have to indicate that there is trouble brewing for you at your work." And she was greatly relieved. And a few weeks later, I said, "Well, how are things going at work?" She said, "Fine." I said, "Did any of those fears of yours pan out?" She said, No, none of them panned out." Well, I sometimes have to give myself the same advice I gave her. When I'm worried or anxious, I'll have to say, "Jackson, you don't know enough to be worried or anxious right now. That's completely unjustified. You know, think about what you know." But a person who is suffering, as Saul was, from paranoia, who has just completely opened the door to an evil spirit so that a demonic power can rule over him and put thoughts in his mind, has just gone off the deep end in thinking that everybody is against him and thinking that this person who has always been loyal to him, his son-in-law David, has now been stirred up by his own son to be out there lying in wait for him. So Saul would actually think, it's just unsafe for me to go out alone because this evil David is after me. It is, of course, one of Satan's masterpieces when people feel this way and they poison the relationships that they could have with other people because of their jealousy and their delusions. And this is what we find here. All of these accusations of Saul are wrong, and he wants to be felt sorry for. He wants to be felt sorry for. None of you feel sorry for me. God help us when what we basically want is pity. I guess many, many years ago, the most miserable man that I ever talked to about his marriage said that what he hoped for was that his wife would feel sorry for him, would pity him. You know, usually I hear guys saying, I wish my wife would respect me. I wish my wife would look up to me as a leader. But this guy was just going to be content if he could just get his wife to feel sorry for him. Brothers and sisters, don't ever get in that kind of state where what you basically want from anybody or from the human race in general is pity. And that's what Saul wanted. None of you are sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as it is this day. And then at this opportune moment, it says in verse 9 that Doeg the Edomite spoke up. Then answered Doeg the Edomite, who stood by the servants of Saul, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech the son of Ahitub, and he inquired of the Lord for him and gave him provisions and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. So he tells Saul that yes, he came to this sanctuary of the priests, and that Ahimelech inquired of the Lord for David, which means, of course, that he interceded for David, he prayed for David. And this is a terrible sin in the sight of Saul, because you're praying for God's will for an enemy. And he gave him provisions and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. So he gave him three unthinkable things as far as Saul is concerned: prayer, sustenance, and a weapon. And in verse 11, then the king sent to summon Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, the priests who were at Nob, and all of them came to the king. And Saul said, hear now, son of Ahitub. The address he gives him shows contempt, because he doesn't even call him by his name. Just like he's no longer calling David, David. He's calling him the son of Jesse. He calls him son of Ahitub. And he answered, here I am, my lord. And Saul said to him, why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, in that you've given him bread and a sword and have inquired of God for him, so that he has risen against me to lie in wait as at this day? He's out to get me. He's out to ambush me. Then Ahimelech answered the king, and who among all your servants is so faithful as David? Who is the king's son-in-law and captain over your bodyguard and honored in your house? The first thing he is saying there is, don't you know David? He is appealing, of course, to what everyone knows about David. And furthermore, he thought, because David had told him, that he was on a secret mission for the king. So he refers to him as his bodyguard and honored in your house. Verse 15, is today the first time that I have inquired of God for him? No. I do that all the time. No, let not the king impute anything to his servant or to all the house of my father, for your servant has known nothing of all this, much or little. Ahitub has two defenses. Ahimelech has two defenses. One about David. How can you think this of him? And one about himself. What's his defense of himself?
Just doing my job.
And I didn't know that he was supposed to be some kind of criminal. I didn't know he was on the run. I didn't know that there was a warrant out for his arrest. And in a normal court of law, that kind of intention or lack of it would carry a great deal of weight, that the person was completely ignorant of any infractions on the part of David. But look at verse 16. And the king said, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house." And the king said to the guard who stood about him, "Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and they knew that he fled and did not disclose it to me." But the servants of the king would not put out their hand to strike the priests of the Lord. Then the king said to Doeg, "You turn and strike the priests." And Doeg the Edomite turned and struck down the priests, and he killed on that day 85 persons who wore the linen ephod. Now, why is Doeg willing to do it, and the soldiers aren't? Doeg's an Edomite. He's not an Israelite. Why is what Saul has just ordered unthinkable and outrageous? Why, even after throwing the javelin at David, even after throwing the javelin at his own son, why is this the low point of his career? What shocks us about this? These are priests. And up until he became king, what was the role of the priest? The role of the priest was to essentially mediate between the people and God in the theocracy. There was no one in greater authority than the priests. There were judges, and to that extent, case law was settled according to the Mosaic law by judges. But the priests had spiritual authority. And the judges, of course, were appointed by God and assumed to carry God's authority in compatibility with the laws concerning the priesthood and the laws that were ceremonial concerning cleanness and uncleanness and sacrifices and so on. What we have here is now essentially the first separation of church and state in the Bible. We have someone who has arrogated to himself a secular authority to persecute these priests. And so this is the first example of religious persecution in Israel. This is the first time it has ever happened. Now, we feel outrage when we read this. And one of the reasons we feel outrage is the fact that these are holy men who were doing their holy duties. They were not complicit with David. They probably didn't even know what Ahimelech had done. And we feel the outrage of the unjust crime from the standpoint of Saul. But there is something else too. And that is, these are Saul's own countrymen. Those of you who know your history, you may remember, especially your English history, you remember that Oliver Cromwell brought in a form of government called the Protectorate after they deposed, after Parliament deposed, tried, and beheaded King Charles I. And one of the most agonizing decisions of Cromwell's life was whether or not he should go ahead and execute Charles I. And it probably was a bad decision from the standpoint of Cromwell's legacy, because he is widely regarded in England at this day, at this time, as a regicide, a murderer of kings. But do you know why he did it? Why he thought Charles I deserved death? Because Charles I had raised a foreign army to fight against his own people, to fight against Englishmen. What was the outrageous thing that Saddam Hussein did? He exterminated the Kurds, members of his own people, members of his own country. And this is the thing that Saul is doing. He's not only persecuting this religious group, but he is persecuting by death his own countrymen. And if you want to see how the outrage grows and turns into bitter irony, read the next verse, verse 19. And Nob, the city of the priests, he put to the sword. Both man and woman, child and infant, ox, donkey, and sheep, he put to the sword. What's ironic about that?
He didn't do it when he was commanded.
He didn't do it when he was commanded to do it to the enemies of God against whom he was leading a holy war, the Amalekites. He wouldn't do it against the enemies of God. He did it against his own people. And therefore, this terrible persecution was a great crime, and from our human standpoint, an injustice. And yet there is more than one standpoint, isn't there? More than one standpoint. You remember how we talked last time about who Ahimelech was? Who was Ahimelech? The great-great-grandson of Eli. And do you remember that there was a prophecy against Eli's house? Turn back to 1 Samuel 2. 1 Samuel chapter 2. And look at verse 31. This is what the man of God had told Ahimelech's great-great-grandfather. Behold, the days are coming when I will cut off your strength and the strength of your father's house, so that there will not be an old man in your house. Then in distress you will look with envious eye on all the prosperity that shall be bestowed on Israel, and there shall not be an old man in your house forever. The only one of you whom I shall not cut off from my altar shall be spared to weep his eyes out, to grieve his heart, and all the descendants of your house shall die by the sword of men. And that began to be fulfilled immediately, as verse 34 predicts, and this that shall come upon your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, shall be the sign to you. Both of them shall die on the same day. And that happened. But this prophecy is of that category of Old Testament prophecies that has an immediate partial fulfillment and then an ultimate future fulfillment. I don't know how many of you, besides David and me, have looked through long-length telephoto lenses. But you get a lens that's 300 millimeter longer, and it compresses things in the distance and shows things up close as if they're close together. So if you took a picture of a mountain range, it would have the foothills and the mountains crammed up together as if they were all at the same place, when in actual fact they might be hundreds of miles apart. Well, in the same sense, there's a prophecy here that had an immediate fulfillment, a partial fulfillment,
But the ultimate fulfillment of this prophecy was on this day when Saul called for the slaying of the priests. So these innocent, and I will put the term in quotation mark, priests were slain. And Saul committed an outrage, the first act of religious persecution in Israel. The interesting thing about this, and the thing that makes the Bible such a fascinating book, is that from the standpoint of Saul, this was an extremely wicked crime. From the standpoint of God's sovereign purposes, this was the fulfillment of prophecy. So let's ask an interesting theological question. Should Saul have been commended for this? Should we append a medal on Saul and pronounce him one of the greatest kings of Israel because he fulfilled the prophecy of God in killing the priests of Nob? I like to make things hard for myself. Shall we sin that grace may abound? God forbid, Paul answered that question. In other words, he was being accused of preaching grace to sinners, which we all love to hear about, and his enemies were saying, well, if you really want to make God look good, let's sin some more, and that'll really magnify his grace. And Paul said, God forbid to that doctrine. God forbid to that doctrine. Why? Well, because human beings are responsible at the same time God is sovereign, and God, as I pointed out Sunday morning, can use an act of wickedness in order to bring about his prophecy. Herod and Pilate and the Jews and the Romans got together to do, the early church said, whatsoever thy hand ordained for them to do. And so, when Time magazine asked a couple of years ago at Easter time, who killed Jesus Christ on the cover? Well, the Romans did, if you watch Hollywood movies that don't want us to think the Jews did. Or, the Jews did, if you watch Mel Gibson movies that are supposedly anti-Semitic. And of course, you can support both from Scripture. Caiaphas called for his death, and Pilate capitulated to them and sent them to be crucified. But the unseen hand above it all was the Lord. It pleased the Lord to bruise him. He has put him to grief. These wicked people did whatever God's sovereign hand wanted them to do. Now, how do we sort this out? Do we say God rejoiced at the death of Jesus, and God rejoiced that day when all of those innocent priests of Nob and their infants and their families were killed? No. What's the factor that you have to figure in these matters? It's the intention. It's the reason. It's the intention of the heart. Take a look with me for just a moment at Isaiah chapter 14. Isaiah chapter 14. There is a promise about the king of Assyria. And it says there in chapter 24, the Lord of hosts has sworn, as I have planned, so shall it be. And as I have purposed, so shall it stand. that I will break the Assyrian in my land and on my mountains trample him underfoot, and his yoke shall depart from them and his burden from their shoulders. Now, here is the problem. He's going to punish the king of Assyria for being his instrument in chastening his people. He's actually going to have the king of Assyria be punished. And so we can assume that in just the same way, God punished Pilate, God punished Caiaphas, God punished the Romans who nailed his son to the cross, and God punished everyone who called for Jesus' crucifixion except those on whom he had grace and answered Jesus' prayer, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And yet, the book of Isaiah says it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He has put him to grief. So the key is the intention. The key is the intention. God intended Joseph to save many people alive, and so he had him sold into Egypt by his brothers. God had good intentions, but the intention of his brothers was evil. You intended evil against me, but God intended it for good. It's the intention of the one who raises his hand against the people of God. And so, brothers and sisters, what you have here in our chapter tonight is one of those things that just makes you throw up your hands and say, "Behold the goodness and the severity of God. His ways are past finding out." We have here an atrocity committed by Saul. We have here something that has its modern counterparts in the regimes of Hitler and Saddam Hussein and other tyrants who engage in mass murder and religious persecution. And at the same time, it's the fulfillment of a prophecy. And that's where you simply throw up your hands and say, "Lord, your ways are higher than mine." And you say by faith, "You do all things well," because he does. All things are good from a good God. And in this passage tonight, this persecution was ordained by God, and yet Saul deserved to be punished for it. Just as the chastening of Israel and Judah by the Assyrians and the Babylonians were ordained by God, and yet the Assyrians and Babylonians deserved to be punished for it. And just as the crucifixion of Jesus was ordained by God in order to save his people whom he loved before the foundation of the world, and yet Herod, Pilate, the Jews, and the Romans all deserved to be punished for it. One just throws up his hands and is forced to worship God when we think on things like this. So let's end the chapter, 1 Samuel 22:20. "But one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David." And here is the reason that Jesus refers to that whole incident of Ahimelech in the days of Abiathar, at the time of Abiathar, in the passage about Abiathar. Abiathar is the son who escapes. Abiathar is now the only living priest left. And he is fleeing after David. And it is this massacre that causes this to happen. Verse 21. "And Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the priests of the Lord. And David said to Abiathar, 'I knew on that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have occasioned the death." Tell Saul, period. "I have occasioned the death of all the persons of your father's house." I want you to notice that statement in 22b. This is one of the great things about David. When David is his normal self, as you and I are when we are our normal selves, our true selves, he feels very, very strongly his responsibility and his culpability in these matters. And when he is being his abnormal, sinful self, He can go for a good long time not thinking about a Uriah, not thinking about a sin with Bathsheba, until suddenly someone comes to him and says, "You are the man." And then his true self took over again and he said, "I have sinned." And David is normally, when he's being his true self, very, very quick to take responsibility. And it is most commendable at the end of this story that he says, "I have occasioned the death of all the persons of your father's house." And it's true. He did. But he says, "Stay with me. Do not be afraid, for he who seeks my life seeks your life. With me you shall be in safekeeping." So the chapter ends on a positive note. This is the one survivor that 1 Samuel 2 predicted, Abiathar, the one who would see all of this carnage of God's judgment and would weep. But God, in His providence, has also placed him with the man who will take care of him, with David. "Stay with me. Do not be afraid, for he who seeks my life seeks your life. With me you shall be in safekeeping." I want to end tonight with an interesting quote from a very great book. The book is called "Their Blood Cries Out," and it's by Paul Marshall, and it's about all of the persecution of Christians that goes on in the world. And it is, of course, much greater than American Christians know, and greater than American citizens in general want to believe. And of course, one of the most offending countries about this is Saudi Arabia. But of course, we immediately think of Sudan. We immediately think of the various countries in the Muslim world that are against Christians persecute them. And what Marshall points out here is this. He says, many Christians in these countries are leading democracy and human rights activists. They're also in the forefront of economic development. But perhaps even more important than what they do is who they are. Even more important than what they do is who they are. While usually loyal citizens, they embody an attachment to another king. Brothers and sisters, that's why they've always been persecuted. A loyalty to a standard of spiritual allegiance apart from the political order. This fact itself denies that the state is the all-encompassing or ultimate arbiter of human life. Regardless of how the relationship between God and Caesar has been expressed, it now at least means that, contrary to the Romans and modern totalitarians, Caesar is not God. This confession, however mute, sticks in the craw of every authoritarian regime and draws their angry and bloody response. Many Christians are therefore persecuted simply because they're Christians. They are usually peaceful and quiet. But these beliefs stand as a rebuke to those who are corrupt, to those who cannot tolerate the presence of any view but their own, and to those who want to make their own political regime the only focus of loyalty. Their very existence is a silent witness to a claim beyond human control. Brothers and sisters, that's why we've been persecuted since the Apostle Paul and Barnabas and Silas were persecuted. This is why we've been persecuted ever since the period of the Neronian persecution in the mid-60s in Rome. This is why persecutions have existed in all countries and throughout the world for centuries. Because we proclaim another king. I have on my computer, as of today, instructions from our missionary David Sitton as to what to do about his ministry in the case of his death, because he intends to preach the gospel to a group of Indians in Mexico called the Kwekwayan tribe. The Kwikoyan tribe doesn't even speak Spanish. But he says that the idea of preaching to them has incited him to get in his house in order in case he dies. Why? Because the Kwikoyan tribe makes its living off of growing marijuana and the plants that are used for cocaine. Their livelihoods depend on marijuana and cocaine. And David Sitton someday is going to tell these people to repent. And they will have a whole lifestyle, a whole economic way of life to repent of. And there will be people who will not want to bow or want any of their fellow tribesmen or their employees or their servants to bow to another king. So I have this on my computer in case David and Uncle Steve face persecution and even death because of the possibility of preaching to this tribe. It's all about whether or not there is another king. Abiathar, at the end of our chapter, is safe because he is with another king. He is with the proper God-ordained, oil-anointed and spirit-anointed successor to Saul. I can't guarantee that you and I will be always safe. But we will always be safe in the sense that we will be in the presence of and in the keeping of another king as long as we keep close to Jesus, regardless of what persecutions come. Persecutions have been ordained. You may face it in your lifetime. I made that point in Sunday morning sermon and in Sunday evening sermon. Because it says that before the throne of God in Revelation 6, there's a group of saints that cry out about the witness they had been born, and about the fact that they were slain for the word of God. And they cry out, O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before you will judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? And I believe, since I believe that the book of Revelation is a series of seven parallel visions, that this describes the state of the martyrs before the throne right now in 2005 and has during this entire church age. And here's Jesus' answer. Then they were each given a white robe and told to rest a little longer until the number of their fellow servants and their brothers should be complete who were to be killed as they themselves had been. God's got a number of the elect and He's got a number of martyr missionaries. He's got a certain number of Christians who will be persecuted for righteousness' sake. I pray that you and I may all escape it. But if it comes to us, let us be prepared for it. And let us be like Abiathar, close to the king and in his safekeeping. Amen.